This episode is brought to you by Tegas, the only investment research platform built for fundamental investors. Think about how hard you are working to get the insights you need to make a great investment decision, how many hours you spend digging through public records and expert transcripts, or manually updating those complex models. Investors should compete on their ability to analyze investments, not how well they aggregate data. That's why Tegas offers a unified end-to-end research platform that combines robust qualitative content sets, up-to-date financial data, management and culture checks, and more, all in one easy-to-use, streamlined user experience. 95% of the top 20 global private equity firms use Tegas. Learn more and get your free trial at tegas.com/Patrick.
This is Business Breakdowns. Business Breakdowns is a series of conversations with investors and operators diving deep into a single business. For each business, we explore its history, its business model, its competitive advantages, and what makes it tick. We believe every business has lessons and secrets that investors and operators can learn from, and we are here to bring them to you. To find more episodes of Breakdowns, check out joincolossus.com.
All opinions expressed by hosts and podcast guests are solely their own opinions. Hosts, podcast guests, their employers, or affiliates may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
I'm Zach Buss, and today we are breaking down the Mitsubishi Corporation. I'm joined by Krishna Mohanraj, a portfolio manager at Diamond Hill Capital Management. When I first connected with Krishna, I cautioned him that tackling a Japanese conglomerate with operations that span energy, retail, manufacturing, mining, automotive, and food, amongst others, would present a tall task. In Japan, the business model of a trading company is prominent. The Big Five trading companies caught the attention of global investors in 2020 when Berkshire Hathaway disclosed a major stake in all of them: Mitsubishi, Mitsui, Itochu, Marubeni, and Sumitomo. Today's Berkshire stake is nearly 10%. In this episode, we discuss how the rich history of trading houses is steeped in Japanese culture and how each differs from one another. We discuss the evolution of stakeholder priorities and how capital allocation policies have changed in the Japanese capital markets. And we spend some time exploring some of the operating companies specific to Mitsubishi. We hope that this episode serves as a strong introduction to the business model of Mitsubishi Corporation.
All right, Krishna, thank you for coming on to talk about Mitsubishi, an audacious goal to break down a Japanese trading house. So at the onset, I wish you luck. But maybe just to start, to set the table, give us a high-level appreciation for what this business is, how big it is, and how you think about the world that they operate in.
Zach, thanks for having me. Excited to be here, especially talking about Mitsubishi Corp. The fascinating thing is, for all its size and reach, it's a company that's not very well understood. It's a huge enterprise, about $135 billion in enterprise value, about $150 billion in revenues last year. Very global. They have their hands on so many different aspects of global GDP. Super long history, going back to the late 1800s. Prestigious as an employer in Japan even today. But despite all that, it's not that widely followed. Not much is written about it in the public domain. It's certainly an odd entity. It doesn't neatly fit into your typical pure play, obvious moat, high returns on capital type business, but fascinating in its own right. So it's really fun to unpack this. Most of us have heard of the Mitsubishi name, especially in the context of cars, electronics, etc. There are actually a family of companies that bear the Mitsubishi name. Mitsubishi Corp is one of them. It's a trading house. They call them Sogo Soshas. There are seven of them now. At one point, there were a lot more, but over time and through various crises, including the fallout of the Japanese bubble in the 80s, that number has shrunk to seven. So besides Mitsubishi, you have Itochu, Mitsui, Marubeni, Sumitomo, Sojitz, and Toyota Tsusho. Obviously, they come with a lot of history, both before and especially after the Second World War, when they contribute greatly to the rebuilding of Japan. So what is inside Mitsubishi? While historically it was a trading company, today you should think of Mitsubishi more as a collection of ownership interests in different businesses. Now, some of them are trading companies, but many are operating companies. They organize themselves under 10 different business groups, but I'm going to simplify it a little bit. If you go by rough profit mix, it's easy to think of Mitsubishi in two halves, as roughly half in resource assets and the other half in non-resource assets. Within resources, you have assets in metallurgical coal, copper, iron ore, LNG, nickel. Most of these are high-quality assets. So you're talking BMA, which is the largest seaborne metallurgical coal mine in Australia. They have a 50% stake in it, along with BHP. The Escondida copper mine in Chile, which is the largest copper mine in the world. The Quellaveco copper mine in Peru, in which they had a 40% ownership along with Anglo American. These are the kinds that they own, typically long-life, high-quality assets. And these are all partnerships or JVs with all the major miners that you know of: BHP, Rio Tinto, Anglo American, Glencore, all of them. So that's one half. The other half, that's non-resources. On this half, you have a mixed bag of assets. You've got about 15% in auto distribution in Southeast Asia. That's basically your full auto value chain: production, sales, aftermarket, auto finance, in partnership with Isuzu and Mitsubishi Motors. And Mitsubishi Corp owns stakes in both of them. Then you got about 10% in food in a few different assets. You have the Lawson's convenience chain, which is a popular chain in Japan, a small stake in KFC Japan. They own the third largest salmon producer in the world called Cermaq, and then several smaller businesses in grain trading, food distribution, etc. Then you got 10% in utilities, which are predominantly North America and Europe. And finally, the remaining is a mixed bag: industrial materials, chemicals, industrial infra, urban development, really a mixed bag of industrial businesses. No doubt that it's a complex collection of assets. How do we see it? Here you have a well-managed business, strong global presence and talent pool, diversified, ultra-conservative balance sheet. And finally, here's the important part: in a clear path toward improving capital efficiency and improving shareholder returns. And you have all that at an attractive price. That's the investment case.
Okay, so this is a pretty basic story, which is good. I think if you consider what they have now, what they own, the partnerships, the JVs, presumably there's a particularly rich history in order to get to where we are today, to this rather high quality amalgamation of assets, which uniquely work together. So how did Mitsubishi get to be what it is today?
The history of Mitsubishi and the trading houses in general, it's very much a part of Japanese industrial history. There's really so much detail and nuance here. So I'm going to shoot for the Cliff Notes version. And I'll start with the punchline: the adaptability of the firm. Mitsubishi has been through a lot of change and has simply adapted and changed form. As you study this history, you will see basically their ability to rethink what it means to be a Japanese corporate citizen, what it means to be Japan Inc., if you will, at each point in time, over 150 years and counting. So we have to start all the way back in the 1850s Japan. The country's forced out of literally 300 years of isolation when they see the American Navy outside their harbors. So Commodore Perry's ships show up in 1853-54. Japanese realize that they're one step away from being colonized. And because they know what happened to their neighbors, the Chinese, priority number one, if they want to escape that fate, was to build a Western-style army and navy. Now, that's easier said than done. They realize that they have to learn from the West. So they begin sending their students to the US as early as 1860. They learn from what happened in the West. They realize that military strength can only come from having a strong industrial base. And to build that strong industrial base, they realize they need the help of private entrepreneurs. Here is when you start to see the beginnings, the origin of the strong collaboration between business and government in Japan, a theme that will continue over the decades, a theme that continues till today. And that's the backdrop for the founding of Mitsubishi. That is the backdrop when a young entrepreneur, Yataro Iwasaki, finds the opportunity to bootstrap this company using a single government contract. So it's 1874. Japan is preparing to launch its first modern military expedition against Taiwan. It's sort of a test and an exhibition of what they're capable of, but it's starting to look like it'll be a profound embarrassment. They have an army, but no navy, and the government was relying on a steamship company called YJK that they had built in partnership with some wealthy families to transport its army to Taiwan. But YJK gets cold feet and declines to support the government in this mission. Enter Mr. Iwasaki. He had just risen to the top of a small shipping firm. He wins this government contract, mostly because the government is desperate. And using this one contract as a base, he renames the firm, calls it Mitsubishi Steamship Company. Mitsubishi literally means three diamond shapes or three water chestnuts, which is the crest of Mitsubishi that we all know. And he builds this into the premier shipping company in Japan at that time. Within a year or so, he takes on the US and British rivals in shipping, gets into a price war with them, and forces them to abandon the key Yokohama-Shanghai shipping route. And that's huge because just a few years earlier, the Japanese were completely dependent on the US and British ships for commercial shipping lanes. So that is the origin. And from then on, you see these powerful families take off. They're called Zaibatsus. As the government realizes you need scale to build industry, they start selectively favoring a few wealthy families. Zaibatsu really means family wealth. And you end up with four big families. So there's Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, and Yasuda. And I think they become so dominant at one point, that's 60% of the market cap in their stock exchange. And they continue to prosper. You get the First World War. Of course, the Europeans are out of business. So these Japanese companies benefit even more. And then all the way to the Second World War, given that link with the government, and given the fact that the government is becoming increasingly militarized, they play a big role in the war. Mitsubishi in particular, Japan's biggest battleships, the infamous Zero fighter plane, Mitsubishi plays a big role. A lot of it is not very good history at the time. And not surprisingly, you wouldn't find these firms wanting to talk about that period much. So that's the first half of the history, the pre-war history. The second half is completely different. It's a completely different world. The US occupation is here. A big focus now is actually dismantling these Zaibatsu. So we're going the opposite direction. Because they were such a big part in the war machine, the US wanted to eliminate Japan's ability to rearm. So they break them up, but that doesn't last for long. You could say it's because typical American interventions after wars in places they know little about never seem to work. You could also say it's because the Japanese government understands very well the need to rebuild. They have a prior roadmap of success with the Zaibatsus. So they selectively, again, encourage scale in the industry. And they do that pretty much by circumventing the anti-monopoly laws that were set up by the US. So Mitsubishi is now already broken up into 170 pieces. But somehow the pride, the networks, the membership, and allegiance with the family name is still not broken up. So very quickly, and this is super surprising, within a couple of years, Mitsubishi is back. It is just in a different form. The new structure, they call it Kiretsus, it is simply the absence of the family. So it's no longer family related. It's more of a horizontal relationship structure. The government does not mandate the structure. That's important to remember. But what it does is it sets the ground for this structure to evolve. So if you think about the next 5-6 decades, these Kiretsus play an important role in the rebuilding of Japan. And through, I guess you could say, the growth in Japan, the bubble in Japan, and the subsequent recession. If you go through it decade by decade, just in Mitsubishi's case, in the 50s, you have the re-establishment of Mitsubishi. You see the building of global networks to become a supplier to manufacturers. 60s, you see high growth. You see them expanding into downstream distribution and exports. 70s, oil shocks, the need to procure oil assets. They become large-scale project organizers. Investments in Saudi Arabia. In general, the beginning of foreign investments, that's when it happens. 80s, you have high-end bubble years, but basic materials are struggling. So a time of restructuring, rethinking. 90s, complete bust, recession, more restructuring. 2000s, again, you got a boom in commodities from China. They benefit from that. And then 2010s, rescaling, realigning. And we'll talk about this later. Over the last decade, it's been increasing focus on capital efficiency. So that brings us to present day. I know that's a long history. That's pretty much 150 years of rethinking what it means to be Mitsubishi.
And then maybe it's just to follow up on that question, just given the rich history here, is there a specific angle that differentiates the trading houses today? Or are they all different and competing on the basis of allocating capital, but operate principally in similar industry?
I would say they're all fairly similar in style. In fact, the thesis for Mitsubishi is very similar to the thesis for pretty much any of the other trading houses. You know very well that Buffett has taken a stake in all five of the large ones. They're all seeing improved capital allocation. They're all making better decisions overall. The difference is primarily in the mix of businesses they own, first. And then second, the areas where they're investing for the future. So the future mix of businesses. And third, maybe I could say clarity around capital allocation priorities. Now, of course, each one is complex. So I'll share some color on how we think about each one of them. But this is going to be very brief and high level. First, Mitsui, great reputation in the resource industry. Versus Mitsubishi, the biggest difference I would say would be Mitsui's iron ore exposure, which is by far their largest individual segment. Now, we prefer met coal over iron ore simply because the supply-demand dynamics appear way more positive for met coal than for iron ore. The seaborne iron ore market is very much dependent on China, versus with met coal, the seaborne market is a lot more diversified. Really, at the end of the day, you're asking, where do you get a more diversified commodity exposure? So that's Mitsui. Second, Itochu, very well run, has the highest ROE of the group. We think very highly of the management team, outside the box thinkers. Versus Mitsubishi, two key differences. One, China exposure. Itochu also has a large iron ore business, that's China. And it also has a major stake in CITIC, which is a Chinese-owned conglomerate. Two, exposure to the Japanese consumer. Itochu has higher exposure and it's well placed if the yen strengthens, but you also have to contend with the demographic headwinds as you obviously have a greater percentage of earnings coming from within Japan. So that's Itochu. Third, Marubeni, a bit smaller, has made great progress over the years within its business. Like Mitsubishi, Marubeni also has meaningful met coal business in addition to iron ore, copper, and LNG. I think the biggest difference here is the ag exposure. Marubeni owns a large US ag business, Helena. So you get exposure to the price vagaries of corn, soybean, et cetera. So that's Marubeni. Finally, Sumitomo. Long history, it was one of the original Zaibatsus. In general, Sumitomo is a little bit more oriented towards heavy industry. So you get steel products, ship, aircraft leasing, infrastructure, et cetera. So that's the different groups in a nutshell. I would say at the end of the day, this is a fascinating group of companies to know and follow. It really comes down to the exposures you would want over the long run and how each one of them would fit in a portfolio.
That's helpful context. And I guess this is a business, as you alluded to, that they almost tried to break up. And despite that, it couldn't help but find itself back together. What is the secret to this business and the way that it's grown so successfully?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is their global network and the relationships. If you look at some of the relationships they have, they go back decades. I'll give you an example. Recently, we saw that they were selling some shares in the Ayala Corporation. Ayala is a conglomerate in the Philippines, publicly traded itself, has a long history, deeply embedded in corporate Philippines. So first off, you're happy that this is in line with our thesis, that they're reducing non-core stakes and possibly returning more capital. But as you dig in into this partnership, you realize that this is a relationship that's 45 years old. The partnership goes across multiple sectors in the Philippines, everything from automobile production, real estate, technology, water, power, infra. Now think about doing business in a place like the Philippines and think about how much of an advantage it is to have a really long-term partnership with a deeply connected local player like that. Even after the stock sale, I think they will own roughly $300 million worth of Ayala stock. So it's not that they're getting out, but even if they are, at this point, given the long history in that partnership, it's not about the stock ownership anymore. this story plays out with Mitsubishi all over the world, because over decades, their DNA is about providing, procuring, building for Japan. And that has meant forming relationships and being able to invest in these networks for the very long term. It's not surprising, given their origins as a trading house. I mean, the nature of a trading house is to build value via networks. The more well-connected people in the network, the more valuable that network is. I'll give an example. If you just think of it as a commodity, you know, historically, Mitsubishi would go into different countries to find raw materials. Eventually, they would start producing a surplus, as you can expect in a cyclical business. And then they'll have to start finding networks to offload that surplus. So after doing this for decades, you become really well-averse at working with suppliers and buyers of raw materials all over the world. And you know that your word is super important. Your reputation is super important. Long-term thinking in those relationships is institutionalized within Mitsubishi. In fact, the most recent annual report, it goes back to the 1870s. Legacy is valued. Also, not surprising that they are willing to make multi-decade investments in long-life assets. Think about it. Some of the largest copper mines in the world, massive LNG projects, they're forced to take the long view. And the corollary to that is they end up with a very, very good reputation. So A, reputation as excellent long-term players. If you speak with mining companies in Latin America, Australia, you'll constantly hear consistent praise for them as long-term partners. B, within Japan, they're highly prestigious as an employer. Just anecdotally, there are multiple Japanese blogs that publish annual rankings of the most desirable employers. I believe they're like number two this year, number one last year. Not that the exact ranking matters. Point being, they're able to attract the best Japanese talent. So overall, it's a powerful collection of moats built over a very long period of time.
And so more recently, Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway have provided what I'll call validation capital to the Japanese trading houses. I believe he owns just under 10% of most of them, or Mitsubishi in particular. Can you talk a little bit about how Berkshire's investment coincided with the market value appreciation we've seen in these equities, and whether that was coincidence or happenstance? How do you think about their impact on how the world views these assets?
When I read Buffett's most recent letter, what surprised me really was how positive he sounded on the management. And this is just my view, and this is purely speculation. When he made the initial investment, that was almost 4 or 5 years ago now, it seemed like it was purely an arbitrage. He could borrow essentially at zero cost in yen and finance the purchase of effectively a slice of global GDP, well managed in a sort of no fuss, almost Berkshire style manner. That was all it was. And also, if you think about it, Berkshire's size, there are so few places that he can deploy large amounts of capital for the very long term. So it didn't strike me that this is the kind of idea that as an independent investor or a retail investor or even an investor in any other structure would want to follow. But then last year, he and Greg Abel went and met with the managements, and we think that's for the first time. And he seems much, much more enthused about the management teams. The stake has, of course, gone up over the time. Like you mentioned, it's now 9% in each of them. And he had very positive things to say on shareholder friendliness, you know, reasonable approach to compensation, unwillingness to issue stock and return capital to shareholders. From our perspective, we have to think a bit differently because we don't get the benefit of the cheap yen funding. It's still a case-by-case bottom-up stock picking decision. But having said that, not a bad fellow shareholder to have. And you can't deny the benefit to Mitsubishi to having such a liquid partner on hand. If you're worried about cyclicality in some of their resource assets, what better partner to have than Berkshire? And to your question on the market moves, you have to also look at the changes in capital allocation that are happening, you know, the actual numbers more than just the talk. I feel the Buffett vote of confidence is important, but it's equally important that the market is seeing capital return for the first time from these companies, and Mitsubishi in particular. It's astonishing the amount of change that's happened over the last 10 years, and it feels like the market is giving credit to it. If you look at 2012, investments net of disposals was about 840 billion yen on an equity base of roughly 5 trillion yen. So that's about 17% net investments net of disposals. Last year, investments itself was down to 125 billion yen. So that's almost 1/8 or 1/7 on an equity base that was almost double of what it was 2012. So as a percentage of equity, that net investment number has come down to 2% from 17%. In effect, you've seen a significant drop in net investments. And not surprisingly, this has led to a significant reduction in net debt, significant improvement in ROE. So while the capital return has picked up in the last couple of years, the process of improving capital efficiency has been going on for a while now. So our view is that the market is slowly beginning to accept that this is a changing situation.
I guess on that particular point, I know that Japanese corporates broadly have been effectively instructed to improve upon capital allocation and return on capital and how to think about driving shareholder returns. What is it that has changed culturally around Japanese businesses and their orientation towards their shareholders?
It's a fascinating question. In fact, one of the learnings for us here is the importance of not just keeping an eye, especially, I mean, when you're investing in international markets, it's important not just to keep an eye on the cultural dynamic, but also how that dynamic is changing over time. In corporate Japan, change has to come from within and has to have a collectivist flavor. It's a collectivist culture. Asking for change in the name of shareholder returns and stock price going up is not going to work. Over the last 20 years or so, you've seen this story play out. Western investors have tried many times to play an activist role. For the most part, the results have been poor because an outsider coming in and telling Japanese management to change, and especially with the logic of increasing share price performance, it was the exact opposite trigger in that culture. What you needed really was a gradual change from within, and the cause always has to be articulated as a positive for Japanese society, not just increasing share price. So to your point, if you really go through the details of what has happened since 2013, in 2013, you have a base structural reform. One of the arrows is economic. 2014, they followed it up with the Aito review, which was one of the documents. For the first time, it had this quote in it. It said, increasing capital efficiency in the broadest sense is crucial from the perspective of Japan's survival. Imagine that. That review tied capital efficiency in the Japanese system to Japan's survival. That was, in our mind, the starting point of change. But even from there, change was very slow. It was consistent, but slow. So from then on, you started seeing internal changes year after year. You got the stewardship code, the corporate governance code, lots of incremental changes there. Market was not willing to buy it because you've seen the market is disappointed before. All the way up to last year, when the TSE basically started naming and shaming companies, it initiated this dynamic of peer pressure, and the need to be a good Japanese corporate citizen was now equated with being capital efficient. So I think as an outsider in global markets, right, you look at this and say, you need to have patience. You need to be a little bit humble to just understand and appreciate how cultural norms are changing. And frankly, that is the fun part of the job, is in investing in international markets, appreciating and understanding these cultural changes.
And so when you guys look at Mitsubishi and try to make sense of fair value in quotes, how do you think about going about valuing a business like this that is so diverse, that has so many minority stakes and partnerships and complexity?
See, typically for a conglomerate like Mitsubishi, you value it on a sum of the parts with some sort of conglomerate discount attached. Mitsubishi does have a lot of underlying parts, like mentioned. And for some of them, which are not listed, you have to make reasonable assumptions. I would say you have enough information to make a reasonable estimate of the sum of the parts, but not a precise one. So in addition to an SOTP valuation, we also triangulate in other ways. For example, management gives you aggregate guidance. Now, that is guidance for this year. You can adjust that with what we think are more normalized earnings assumptions over time for the underlying businesses, adjusting for your assumptions in commodities and currencies. That'll get you to a normalized earnings number. And we get to anywhere between 800 billion to 1 trillion yen per annum. I would say, as an aside, when you're coming up with normalized earnings on a mining business, it's super important to mention that the vast majority of Mitsubishi's resource businesses all have solid long lives, 30 plus years, and will be used and necessary in the world for decades, which gives us some comfort in thinking about normalized earnings. You definitely don't want to do that in a mining company with a short mining life. So the 800 billion to 1 trillion yen is roughly a 6, 7% earnings yield on the current market cap. Now, on top of that, think about the improving capital allocation, and we end up with a reasonable, you know, mid-single digit type profit growth over time. Given that, we think at current prices, you'll end up with low mid-teens type return going forward. Now, of course, when we initiated the position, the return profile looked much better, but we do think this is more of a long-term holding for us.
And so when you look at what they've been doing, where they've been redeploying capital, presumably that provides some insights into how management is thinking about growing the business and where to reinvest. So if you think about the reinvestment opportunity here, where are they allocating capital?
Let me first start by saying the trading house moniker, it made sense a while ago. But today, as we said, it is less of a trading business. It's more a collection of ownership interests. You have to think of this as a constantly evolving mix of businesses, sort of a slow-moving battleship, divesting and investing over time. As far as how they think about these investments and divestments, all you get is a few general themes. One, a focus on ROE, that they want to improve capital efficiency in non-performing businesses. And if they can, they want to exit. Two, they have a general interest in secularly growing commodities. So they want to invest in copper, LNG, met coal. They believe they have the assets and the capability to play a role in the energy transition. So if you look at their current midterm plans, half of all the investments are going into metallurgical coal, utilities, LNG, and some into convenience stores and salmon farming type businesses, more steady consumer businesses. It gives you a sense of where the mix is headed. But this is a slow-moving ship with very long time horizons. They typically invest through JVs and partnerships. So we don't expect big changes or high-profile acquisitions. Also, now with the Berkshire relationship, it is an obvious positive in terms of keeping, I guess, an elder in the room checking on capital allocation over time. They are in even more of a position of strength when it comes to these partnerships. In fact, Buffett said that in his letter. He indicated that one of the attractions is that investing in the Sogo Socias might lead to opportunities for partnership around the world. So all in, the way we think about it is you are getting a good set of assets and a lot of bloat, poor businesses, non-core stakes, and cross-holdings, and you're seeing that clear intent to improve capital efficiency.
If you think about Berkshire and the way that it's run in a somewhat decentralized manner with Warren Buffett and formerly Charlie Munger sitting at the top and redistributing capital through their businesses, management and that type of structure obviously is important. How important is management to a business like Mitsubishi?
Pretty much every other investment that I've analyzed, if you ask me the name of the CEO, it'll come to me right away. But Mitsubishi is an exception in the sense that you don't even think about the name of the CEO. The biggest learning from this is that actions matter more than words. And when you have such a long culture of collectivist long-term thinking embedded in a business, the CEO, while important, is not the key part of the thesis. The typical CEO, especially the Western CEO, is a talker, extremely good at playing to the stands. Any average investor coming out of a meeting with a CEO is not going to be disappointed. Most CEOs know exactly what you want to hear. Their experts are articulating the right message. With Mitsubishi, it's almost the opposite. You get none of that. You get numbers they report, metrics that they track, and straight, fairly boring statements about what exactly is going on. But think about the actions that they've done. The number of businesses that they have divested, the number of stakes reduced, the quantum of capital returned just in the last couple of years. It's an impressive amount of change in a short period for a company with such a long history. Imagine if any Western company is doing all this, the amount of headlines, the amount of selling you will get. Mitsubishi, you don't have any of that. And part of it is also, it's less of a star CEO culture, no fuss, No one is trying to get on the cover of Fortune 500. It's more of a patient, long-term collectivist culture. So I would say the thing that stands out to me in this investment is you don't always need a star CEO. Specific action over generic talk, that's something you want to learn to recognize in every investment.
And then when you look across their operating companies, of which there are many, perhaps the right question is specific verticals. Are there any that stand out to you from a fundamental perspective that are particularly important? Or is it more so just the way they all work together is the crux of the business model?
I think the crux of the business model is how they all work together. If you wanted me to point out something that might be maybe more important than the rest, I could mention that they have a fairly large exposure to metallurgical coal, and they certainly believe that that is undervalued and it's going to play a significant part in the energy transition. So that is definitely one exposure that we are very mindful of. In fact, it's an exposure we really like. Outside that, view it some of the parts as the secret sauce really comes from the network.
Yeah, I mean, I would be curious if you could just maybe give us a bit of a crash course in how you think about their met coal business and why it's so important in regards to future and energy transition.
It's used in the process of making steel. About 70% of global steel production is done this way. You know, blast furnace takes iron ore and met coal or coking coal as key inputs and produces steel. This is different from thermal coal, which is lower quality coal. It's burned at power plants for electricity. The thermal coal is more easily replaced over time by natural gas. But there is currently no substitute for high quality met coal in the blast furnace production process. Also, if you think about the green transformation, met coal is a positive because it allows for building all the infrastructure, the wind turbines, the EVs that are enabling the energy transition to happen. That is 70% of all steel production. The other 30% is done through electric arc furnaces. These are typically, they take scrap metal and melt it down to produce new steel. That's an environmentally friendly way to make steel, and how I would say the majority of steel in the US is produced today. I do think EAF or electric arc furnaces will take time and will take share from blast furnaces, but it's going to take a long time. And blast furnaces are still being built in Asia. Ultimately, if you put numbers to it, I think probably met coal demand is basically flat over the next few decades. As you see incremental growth in India and Southeast Asia being offset by lower growth in developed markets. Now, there is a lot of talk, and I have to mention that, a lot of talk of EAF furnaces taking share, and for sure they will over time. But just for reference, the percentage of steel being produced by electric furnaces was 29% in 2012. It's barely moved in the last 10 years, while total steel production has increased over that time. So that's the demand side. But supply side is where it's really interesting. It's almost impossible to open new coal mines. Besides not being able to get approvals, you won't get bank financing. Insurance providers hesitate to support anything to do with coal. So if you think about the fact that 70% of global steel is still produced via blast furnaces, and that's going to require iron ore and met coal for now, and blast furnaces are still being built to last for decades, we think there is support for that commodity for the next few decades. And that is Mitsubishi's view as well.
And so you've provided a good summary of a business on the resource side. I thought it'd be interesting if we dug a little bit deeper onto a non-resource business of theirs. If there's one that you care to talk about, I'd love to hear you explain the strengths of that business.
Yeah, on the non-resource side, I think we should talk about Lawson's. It's a Japanese convenience store chain. It's half owned by Mitsubishi. It's also interesting because it was in the news recently because it is a listed company and is being taken private by Mitsubishi and KDDI, which is another Japanese company. After this transaction, Mitsubishi will continue to own half of Lawson. So really not much is changing, except Lawson will no longer be a listed entity. Again, if you dig into Lawson's fascinating history, which is probably the theme throughout this conversation, Lawson actually had its origins in Ohio. It was a convenience store business started in Hoga Falls, Ohio, but today exists predominantly as a Japanese business focused on convenience stores. So 70% of the profits today come from Japanese C-stores. The rest is a collection of different things. There's a supermarket business called Seijo Ishii, a small overseas convenience business, some mixed entertainment businesses, travel, ticketing, movie theaters and the like, and a little bit of financial services. The focus, of course, is Japanese C-stores. They have 14,600 C-stores as of late last year in Japan. And the format is pretty common. Typically, you'll have a store at the base of a large commercial building. You can buy snacks, daily sundries, pre-made food, things like that. Not dramatically different from any urban convenience store that you would see in New York City or London. Though if you end up visiting there, you'll see that the quality of the food, the cleanliness of the place, it's a world better than any of the Western peers that we are used to. It's a very consolidated industry. Three players, 7-Eleven, Family Mart, and Lawson account for 85%+ of sales in Japan, with Lawson around 22%. Just as an aside, Family Mart, one of the other players, is 100% owned by Itochu, which is, of course, one of the large trading houses as well. Growth really has to come from product and services because in Japan, the total number of C-stores is not growing. So the focus really is on improving same-store sales. Another big effort, and this is where the Mitsubishi ecosystem comes into play, is to improve profitability through vertical integration. If you think about the advantage of Mitsubishi Group, this is a great example. There are many levels here. One, Mitsubishi owns a distribution company called Mitsubishi Shokuhin that has Lawson as its largest customer. So you get that tight vertical integration link here. And then further down, Mitsubishi has businesses in livestock feed, poultry, swine breeding, chicken processing, seafood processing, flour milling, all of these ancillary food businesses. They're all producing products that move into their convenience stores and are profitable in their own right. So in effect, Lawson might be, say, 3-4% of Mitsubishi's profits, but the impact goes much higher if you think about all the allied businesses that are linked to Lawson. If you had to summarize Lawson, on one hand, it's low growth. It's impacted by the demographic headwinds you see in Japan, but the C-store is a highly stable source of cash flows and also a nice certain source of demand for many of the other Mitsubishi businesses, which is really nice given some of the cyclical commodity type businesses we talked about earlier.
Well, Krishna, taking Mitsubishi Corp and trying to distill it down into a short conversation is not something easy. I think you did a great job summarizing the strengths of the business and how we got here today. As you reflect upon what you've learned about Mitsubishi and your study of the business, what are the lessons that you take and apply to other potential investments? And then beyond that, what are lessons in how Mitsubishi has created value that you think could be borrowed by other companies to create value in their own endeavors?
I mentioned a couple of these. Let me reference them. The first, the idea of looking for actions over words. As an analyst looking at investments, that is something that definitely worth taking from the Mitsubishi experience. The second would be, again, something I mentioned already, keeping aware of cultural changes and having that little bit of patience and humility when analyzing businesses in a different cultural setting. Finally, I'll say one important lesson for me personally has been just the ability to take the big picture view. And here, I have to give a shout out to my colleague, Micah Martin. He did all the work as the analyst on the name. And when he pitched it to the team, it was a struggle for us to digest as a team initially. Because let's face it, as you mentioned, this is a beast of a company. And the typical analyst, including me, when I first looked at it, will so easily get lost in the details. To look at this, you need the flexibility to think big picture. You need to stop with the geeky urge to build fancy Excel models or wanting to nail down 5-year revenue numbers. You need to do good valuation work as always, but that valuation work needs some creativity. Ultimately, we're getting a good collection of assets that are well managed and you're paying less than what this business is worth. Ultimately, that's what matters for any investment.
Krishna, I appreciate you coming on and doing this. I know Mitsubishi, along with the other trading houses, could probably be a couple hours for each separate division. So this was a big one to tackle, and we appreciate you taking the time to introduce us to this business.
Zach, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
To find more episodes of Breakdowns ranging from Costco to Visa to Moderna, or to sign up for our weekly summary, check out joincolossus.com. That's JoinColossus.com.
A quick note before you go. If you are a company hiring or a candidate looking for your next opportunity, make sure to check out joincolossus.com/recruiting. We launched our recruiting efforts at the end of last year. We started working with firms that were interested in tapping into our audience. And after seeing some early success, we want to open this up to additional firms and to candidates who are proactively looking for their next opportunity. So we are mostly revolving around the investment world and the tech industry. But again, make sure to check out joincolossus.com/recruiting for more information.